in our morning get together. Gail, are you still here? No, come on up. Gail Hansman. Oh, you're right. All the kids can go that want to. Boy, they want to. Massachusetts? You're from Massachusetts? West Springfield? From a life of pain to a smiling Christian. Gail's 13 years as a Jehovah's Witness include a divorce, custody battles, attempted suicide, but Jesus brought her peace and joy. With her husband, Jim, she started Set Free Ministries. Boy, we get to hear you. Thank you.
Oh. There you go. Oh, I wrote this whole thing out. I mean, it's my life. You think I wouldn't forget it, but I figured maybe I might, so I should write the whole thing out. So you see me shuffling through this whole big stack of papers here because I'm trying to figure out where I am. First thing I'd like to do is thank Joan and Bill for having this convention for all these years. Even though I've only been coming here... Even though I've only... What?
You want this next year?
Yes. Even though I've only been coming here for 4 years, it's just been such a blessing, and this place is so beautiful. And the sun's coming out now, and the rain knocked off a lot of leaves, but it's still so nice and just so wonderful how the Lord has led you to have this ministry and to really help all these people. And just to tell everybody a little bit about how I started coming here. It was through a pastor after I had gone through a lot of difficulty. He was an Indian pastor. His name is Emmanuel Huck. It's spelled H-A-Q-Q. And he's just this big, really loving guy. And he gave me this magazine, Eternity. This was in 1983 that he gave me this. And this magazine was 3 years old at the time. It was in 1980 that this magazine came out. And there was an article in here. It's why I was kicked out of the Watchtower. I never read the article. All I saw was this little italicized little area here. And it says, Bill Centenar is a stockbroker and travels widely lecturing on Jehovah's Witnesses. He has organized the Ex-Jehovah's Witness for Jesus, which is sponsoring a convention at Blue Mountain Christian Center. And it said it drew over 400 people. Well, of course, being an ex-witness, I couldn't figure out who would go to an ex-witness convention except ex-witnesses. And I figured there were 400 of them. Well, I never knew what happened to ex-witnesses. And then I knew. I'm like, now I know where the ex-witnesses are. They're all in Pennsylvania at this convention. I mean, that's the way the article didn't say who were the 400 were, so I figured that's what it was. So I said to myself, I have to come and see. That's right, because I was afraid of ex-witnesses. I was afraid of Christians, and I was afraid of ex-witnesses. I was afraid of everybody. So I said, I'm going to go. But I didn't go. I didn't go right away. Finally, I got up the nerve. If you know anything about my life, I'm very disorganized. And I moved 2 times with this magazine. I never gave it back to the pastor. He never told me I could keep it. I figured after this convention, I would give it back to him. But this book, I never lost. I lose everything. I lose my pocketbook. I lose my shoes. I lose everything. I never lost this magazine, never. And I moved 2 times, and it was over a period of maybe 2 years that I had this magazine, and I never lost it. I read the article when I was writing my talk. I said, I'm going to read the article. But it was everything that I already had known about you anyway from reading your Questions to Jehovah's Witness book, right? But I had this, like I said, it's 1980, and I had it, and I can't believe it was just the Lord really guiding me with this, that really I held on to this because I lose everything. And when I decided that I would come, I wrote to Joan, and I had just missed the convention, and she wrote back to me and told me that I had just missed it, but to, you know, try and come next year, and so I did. And when I came, that was when Bill had first gotten sick. That was my first year. And Joan said, we almost didn't have the convention because, you know, Bill says, I can't talk. And Joan says, I can't talk. And I'm there. And so finally, she said, well, I guess I'll have to talk. And so she did. And what a blessing, because everyone was blessed that year, especially me. And I would have been heartbroken if they hadn't had it. And it's just terrific to see how Bill's come along. And I just really just praise God for you. And I can just see him really just working through you too, to so much good. Well, and then as I pondered about what I was going to talk about, because my husband had written to Joan and Bill and told them a little bit about me, and Joan contacted me and asked me what my title for my talk was, and I was like, I don't know if I can really do this. My life as a witness was really not what a lot of people here had for a life. I was, you know, my husband was not a witness. He was an unbelieving mate. And there's a lot of women in this organization who have husbands that aren't witnesses, and it's a lot different than seeing the couples up here. The life that those women have is really different. It's different than the circuit overseer, the district overseer, the elders, the pioneers, and everything. When you're struggling with little children, it's really, really difficult. And I thought, gee, you know, what am I going to say to these people, you know, about my life? And I really realized, really sat down and thought about what the reason was for my talking. And it was really to bring glory to Jesus and to let everybody know really what he can do in your life. You know, when you think that it's at the lowest point, that he can really lift you up. And when I was a witness, I tried the vacation pioneer, and I did the best that I could, and with the children and going out. And I would frequently forget to report my time, and I'd always be, you know, saying, well, you're going out, you know, you're taking all these magazines, you must be doing something. I had garbage bags full of magazines. I don't know how many other people here had tons of magazines that they never placed, but I had tons of them. I had them up in my attic. I had them everywhere. I didn't know what to do with all these magazines, because I had an elder talk one time, and he said, when you get the magazines, he was a circuit overseer or something. He said, they come in that brown sleeve. He said, when John comes to visit, you wouldn't just rip his coat off. He said, so you slip it out of the sleeve, and you open it up, and you read it. He's there, and then after you've read it, you fold it back up, and you put it back in the sleeve, and you send it to somebody else. So I had this real attachment to the magazines after that. And I thought, you know, it would be like throwing John away or something, you know. So I didn't throw them away, but I didn't want to tell anybody that had all these magazines. So I didn't know what to do with them, so I just kept them. Now I wish I had all those magazines, because after 13 years of hundreds of magazines, I mean, up in my attic, when I went to move, my mother said, let's throw all these to the dump. So I did, and now I could just kick myself, because I would love to have had them all, because I mean, I see people buying these magazines that I bought for 25 cents each, or whatever they were then, you know. You know, a couple of dollars, and now, you know, I think, well, gee, I had a gold mine up there, maybe, you know. And the other thing is, too, is that, you know, as a woman, we were never allowed to stand here at the podium. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to sit over here and face another sister and talk to her for 10 minutes. Oh, can you hear me? I don't like this thing in my face. So anyway, just to tell you a little bit about myself, I was raised an Episcopalian. And, you know, my parents did the best that they could. They took me to Sunday school and church. But I always felt very distant from God, and I really didn't know Jesus as my Savior. So I got married when I was 18, and my husband-to-be, Herb, had never been baptized. He had never, ever gone to church. He didn't have any Christian upbringing at all of any sort. So he had to be baptized before he could get married in the Episcopal church. So I ended up being his godmother. I had a witness this whole thing. He didn't want to do it, but he just did it so we could get married in the church. And we got married, and he never ever went to church after that. So I would go alone. Eventually I got tired of it. So I stopped going too, because I figured, well, it was just out of habit. I wasn't getting anything out of it anyway. And I started really reading my Bible at home and praying that God would lead me, you know, to the way that I should go in a church, because I was in a strange town and didn't know anybody. So eventually I made this new friend, Judy, who was studying with Jehovah's Witnesses. And she said that an elder was coming over to talk to her husband, and would I like to come and hear what he had to say? So I said, sure. So I went over, and after the elder was through talking to her husband and myself, he said, would you like a study, Ron? And Ron said, no. And I said, yes. And he said, He said, okay. He said, but men can't study with women. You have to study, you know, with a woman. He said, so my wife will study with you, Nancy. And I said, oh, that's great, you know. So I went right after it. There was no doubt in my mind that this is what I wanted to do. Well, this was 1971, and the first big change really that came when I started studying was my miniskirts had to go. You know, they were really short. I weighed about 120 pounds, so I look good in these real short skirts. But Herb wouldn't have anything to do with it. He liked the short skirts, and they were going to stay. So I had two sets of clothes. One was about 10 inches longer than the other one. One I could wear to meetings, and the other one I couldn't, because the first time I showed up in my miniskirt at that Kingdom Hall, those elders, I said, no, somebody that dragged me right back to that library and told me that I couldn't come there like that anymore. Of course, that Nancy that I was staying with, she almost died of a heart attack, you know, but she didn't say anything to me. I should have, you know, she was kind of like, you know, but I should have known then that, you know, something was up. But, of course, the more changes that came, the birthdays and the holidays and everything else, you know, Herb became more and more upset. And our marriage wasn't going good in the first place, so now adding all this other tension to it was really, really bad. And so I said that I wanted a divorce because I just really couldn't take it. And Nancy told me, no way. She said, you don't get a divorce. She says, eventually when you're studying, he'll come around to the truth, you know. By your, I forget how it is that they put it, you know, but they just said that, you know, he would come around and that, you know, just hang in there. So I said, okay, I would. You know, and I just really alienated all my friends and family, you know, and just really went with the witnesses and decided I would do this the whole way. I even had a cousin who said to me, I was telling everybody, I said, well, all right, you know, this was now like 1972, and I said, I can stand Herb for 3 more years. I said, 1975 is coming, 3 more years, well, I can do anything for 3 more years. So I said, okay, we'll stick this out, you know. So I kept on telling everybody, 1975. I didn't make this up myself. This was definitely preached by the organization. I mean, I heard it in meetings. I heard it all the while I was in my Bible study when I was learning about it. I figured 1975 was it. And I had a cousin who didn't believe it. Can you believe it? He didn't believe it. He would not believe me. So he said, 1975, he said, on New Year's Day, 1976, I'm going to bring X-rated movies to your house. And you're going to watch them. And I said, fine. Because I never really believed it would happen. He never brought the movies. I asked him about it just recently when I was thinking about it. And he said that he felt so bad for me because he knew I had really believed it, that he wasn't serious about it. That he said, I was just kidding you. I didn't think you'd agree to it, you know, which I wouldn't have. But nobody believed me. I even had an aunt that was a professional lecturer in California, and she came flying all the way out here and stood in the middle of my living room and ranted and raved about everything that was bad about Jehovah's Witnesses. And so that's why I can really see, even in my own ministry, why that doesn't work, because nothing she ever said ever penetrated me. She just screamed and yelled and ran. I mean, she had a whole written speech, I mean, big papers, and she's flipping through them all, and I just said, no. I didn't believe anything she said. And even a couple of things that maybe I doubted, when I asked Nancy about it, she quickly passed them right off. Eventually, I disassociated myself from the Episcopal Church and decided to get baptized. And when I wrote to the pastor of the church, he didn't even respond to it. And he sent me a letter saying that I was behind in my pledge. Could I bring it up to date? So that just convinced me, everything that the witnesses said, that all the churches were after were money. And that was the only thing they wanted. So after I was baptized in 73, I had my daughter, and then the trouble really began, because the stress of having a baby around and my and Herb the way that he was just a constant battle in the house continually. He was very verbally and emotionally abusive to me anyway. He always had been, always putting me down and things like that. And then the tension of the baby, it really, really got bad. And having to bring the baby to the meetings alone and all those meetings every week and out in field service. And when the district and circuit assemblies came around, I was just, everybody else would be all happy, right? You know how they all act? Oh, the assemblies, you know. And they'd all be so excited about going. And I dreaded it. It took me a week to recover afterwards. And then when I had my second son, Matthew, 2 years later, the problems just increased. And everybody kept saying, well, you know, you'll win him over to the truth, you know, by your actions and the way you are. But it didn't. It didn't change. I tried to be submissive to my husband, and I tried to be obedient to the organization. But I couldn't put in enough time in the organization. I couldn't place enough magazines. I couldn't have enough Bible studies. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't. Inside, I just felt like I could never please the organization. And the same way with my husband. I could never please him. I never could keep the house clean enough. The kids could never behave enough. You know, the birthdays and the holidays, you know, it was just like a bomb. It was like snowballing. It was just getting bigger and bigger. Well, finally, I got pregnant again with a third child. And Herb said, I don't want any more kids. He said, you're going to have an abortion. And I said, you know, not only that I was a witness and I couldn't have an abortion, you know, I just personally myself, you know, I couldn't give a child up, you know, for adoption. So how could I give it up even to kill it? You know, I just couldn't do that. So he said, well, then in that case, he was going to leave me. So I said, well, that's good. But he didn't leave me. What he did was he moved out of our bedroom into the den and tormented me. You know, by continually following me around the house, nagging at me all the time and being really mean to me, you know, but never really ever going, just emotionally going and staying around to abuse me. I was in such I was so worked up. I wanted to leave. The elders said, you can't leave. I mean, I don't know what they wanted. They wanted to wait till I was dead, till I could go. I don't know if they're going to carry me out of there. But so I stayed, and eventually I just got so worked up. I ended up having a miscarriage like at 5 months. And then the guilt set in that somehow I had caused all this, that if I had been really relying on the Lord and doing what I was supposed to do, that never would have happened. And so that caused a lot of problems. After I had the miscarriage, he figured, well, life was going to go on as normal now. Now we were back to our two little kids and our fine little family and everything like that. But my heart at that point had just turned to stone. I felt nothing but hurt and anger, but there was nobody that I could express it to. You know, nobody else seemed to, you know, really understand or anything, you know. They all said, well, you know, just go on, everything will be fine. And I'm like, I just got really tired and sick, and I didn't want to go out and field service. I didn't want to do anything. So I went to the doctor and said, there must be something wrong with me. So he did every test that he could do, and he said that there was nothing wrong with me. He said, you're perfectly healthy. He said, you must be depressed. He said, you should go to a psychiatrist. I couldn't believe it. I said, I said, I'm not depressed. You know, I don't, how could he say I was depressed? Jehovah's people are happy people. You know, you know, I'm happy, you know. And so I figured I must have something wrong with me. You know, he didn't do a CAT scan. I could have had a brain tumor. I, you know, low blood sugar was a real popular thing back then. And I figured maybe if they did more testing, they really would find something wrong with me. But so I went to the elders about it anyway. I said, you know, I don't know what's wrong with me. I said, I'm just really depressed. Well, they told me that it was me, that I must be doing something wrong in my life that was hindering my relationship with Jehovah. And that if I straightened it out, that, you know, I would be okay. I couldn't figure out what else I could do. I was doing everything that I could. And the abuse just really worsened with Herb. He started being physically abusive to the children. He'd throw them around and really hit them hard. I was never spanked when I was a child, so I never was physical with the kids. I never hit them. I would always talk to them, and he would say that he wasn't really hitting them that hard, that I was just overreacting because I had a different view of discipline than he did. And I didn't feel that was the case. I really didn't. A couple times I would even have to leave the house because I thought that he was really going to hurt him, and I would go to witnesses' houses. So everybody knew what was going on, you know, because I would go over to their house, and he'd call up, and we'd go back. And I talked to the elders about it, you know, and people say, well, why didn't you, you know, go to, like, some of those, oh, what do they call them, places where you can go for abused children or, you know, or get some kind of help like that. And you know, people now will say that to me, and I'll say, because in the organization you just didn't do that. You didn't seek outside help. And I kept going to the elders, and I kept on saying, well, everything will be okay, you know. Just pray and wait on Jehovah, and he'll do everything okay. Well, then Herb got laid off, and things get worse when people are laid off. So I went to work, and then I had to leave him with him, and it was just a disaster. So pretty soon he got back to work, and we put the kids in daycare, and he never came around or anything. to pick them up or drop them off or anything. I had to do everything, all the meals, dragging the kids back and forth, meetings. You know, I was just a super mom. And I just decided I really had to get out. I said, I can't do this anymore. So I figured the only way was to go back to college. So that's what I did. And, of course, that went over like a lead balloon with the organization. All of my friends were criticizing me because of it. And I just said, this is it. I have to get an education, because if I get an education, I can get out of here. And I can support my kids, and I won't have to worry about it. Because, see, just like the organization sisters, where are you going to go if you leave? There's no place for you to go. That was the same thing that Herb did to me. As he said, I couldn't support myself. He wouldn't support me. Where would I go? What would I do? What man's going to want a woman with two kids? I mean, you don't have anywhere to go. So in one way, emotionally, I didn't have anywhere to go with Herb or anybody else. And the other way, with the organization, I had nowhere to go. So I figured the only thing was was to get an education and get out. So I did. I went back to college, and I became a registered nurse. And I decided that was it. I was going to leave. And when I did that, during my last year of college, Herb was screaming and yelling one day like he always did. And he said, well, if you don't like it, get out, or I'll get out. And I said, good, go. And he couldn't believe it. I said, yes, I want a divorce. Well, he couldn't believe it. So what did he do? He went running to the elders. And he told them he wanted to be a witness. And so, of course, you know what that did. I spent more time in that library. I could have read every book for all the time I spent back there. And they kept calling me in, and Herb wanted to study, and you know that traveling district overseer and stuff like that comes. And I told him everything that had been going on, and he scolded Herb, and he said, that's terrible that you did all this and everything, you know. But he said, but you have to, you know, try and work it out. After all, he's going to be a witness now. I said, no way. I said, I'm not going back. I said, I'm not. I want this divorce. And they took his side against me. And my best friend was also having problems with her husband. She was a witness. And her husband reported her. The elders called her in. And she said, yes, she had done wrong things. And they disfellowshipped her. And she had told me that she was repentant. She was sorry she had done it. And I went to the elders about it. I said, you know, she says she's sorry. Well, that was a big mistake. You don't go to the elders about somebody that's been disfellowshipped. Because now I spent more time in the library. Because they told me it was none of my business. And I said, but, you know, it's not right she was disfellowshipped. They couldn't believe, once I got going, there was no shutting me up. Her husband was also a witness, this friend of mine. And when they got to court, she told the truth, and he lied. So I went to the elders about that. And I said, that here he is a witness in good standing. You know, she's not. She's disfellowshipped, and he's lying. They didn't care. I couldn't believe they didn't care. And anyway, so she was disfellowshipped, and I continued to talk to her on the telephone. And the elders knew. Now, how did the elders know? Because they call me and they tell me, you know, I'm talking on the telephone. My husband had the telephone line tapped and was listening. I mean, you think I was the Kennedys or something, you know? It sounds like Peyton Place, but... Yeah, and he was sharing all our telephone conversations with the elders. They were all listening, and with, you know, my girlfriend's husband and everybody else. And it was how I found that out was one of my friends that was a witness. Herb had went to her husband and told him that he was doing this. And so she told me, she said, you better stop talking on your telephone. She said, because, you know, Herb's listening in. And eventually I was followed by the elders, and they said that they saw my car over at her house and over at unbelieving people. And I said, yeah, that I was. I said, you were following me. And they said, no, we weren't. We just happened to drive by and see your car. But one elder even told me, he said that I'm not my brother's keeper. That was the expression he used. And he said, you know, I didn't have any business being worried about her. I just couldn't believe my ears. And they said, if you continue to talk to her, go over her house or whatever, we're going to have to take action against you. Herb knew from listening to my phone conversations that the only thing that I really cared about was finishing college and taking care of the children. And I went to a court and I got a restraining order against him because he threatened to blow my head off. He said that he was going to kill me because I was leaving him. I mean, he figured the witnesses didn't work, nothing worked, so this was it, that he was going to kill me. And he said this in front of the children. They were really upset. And so I went to court, and I got the restraining order, and he was furious, but he he stayed away from me, and he didn't hurt me. And he kept on with the witnesses and everything. He was moved out, and I was there alone. And I wrote a letter to headquarters, and I wrote a letter to the elders and told them that I was resigning because, you know, they told me if I stopped seeing my friend, I'd be thrown out. And, you know, I didn't stop associating with people that weren't witnesses, so I just said, well, that's it, then I'll leave. So I wrote a letter thinking that at headquarters at least and told them all these things that were going on that they would respond to me, and they never did. And I was really sad about that because I always believed that it was God's organization. Even my girlfriend that was disfellowshipped, we always said to each other that we would never speak against the organization because we really believed it to be God's, but there was something wrong with the congregation that we were in. But we both were going our separate ways. And during this time, my neighbor was attending an evangelical church. And she asked Christina to go with her, and Christina asked me if Christina could go with her. She was 10 at the time. And I said, sure, what does it matter now? We're going to die at Armageddon anyway, so she might as well go. Christina would get up every morning and get dressed and go to church for this woman every Sunday morning. And she was so cute. She would always beg me to go with her. She'd say, please come, you really like it. So I went with her a couple times, and I would sit in the back and just really hate it. And my grandmother died about the same time, and I was very close to her. And I went to the church, and I just had palpitations and felt sick and everything, and I couldn't even stay during the service. That's how bad it was going. And then finally, the final court date came for our divorce. I was now a nurse. I had gone through all the state boards and everything, and things looked like they were going to finally work out. Herb had agreed to the financial settlement, and the kids were going to live with me and everything. So when I signed the final papers and we all got our financial part, you know, it was divided up and everything, the very next day Herb refiled for custody of the kids. And the only reason he did that was because he knew that was the one thing that I had left. Everything else was gone. He then started really emotionally getting to the kids. He said that he would kill himself if they didn't come live with him. And so this went on, and the kids really started turning against me. I was working 11 to 7 so I could be with them during the day. And so, of course, I was tired, and he hadn't given us any support for over a year. And so, I was just really getting down. I was so depressed that I had started taking the kids to a psychiatrist to help them get through all this abuse with their father, and I was going myself, and they started putting me on antidepressants. And when you're on antidepressants, they go higher and higher, and it causes a chemical reaction in your brain. You don't get a high, actually, from the pills, but it's supposed to make you feel better. Well, I just took more and more, and you're not supposed to drink alcohol when you take these pills. And I just started drinking and taking them, and I would just pass out, to go to sleep at night. And this is what I would do. Even though I was a nurse and I knew that I could kill myself. I knew that I could take those and not wake up. And every time it would be a little bit more and a little bit more, I would figure maybe I wouldn't wake up. Till finally I would really overdose on them, except I would become very physically ill. I couldn't just lay down and die like everybody else would. No, I had to get sick. But I just can't explain the depths of depression that I went into because the kids, when we went to court, the kids were saying that they wanted now to go with their father because he was lavishing them with all these gifts. It was being the father that they always wanted. And I was the grouch. And I was the one that broke up the marriage. I was the one that had left. And so they said that they wanted to go with him. And even though I presented all these things to the probation officer and that was investigating the case, she said that Herb was the stable one, that he was indicating that he was reliable and I was crazy. And, it was funny because when it came down to we were going to go to court, I was going to fight it anyway. I said, well, still I'm going to fight it, even though, I think that I'm going to lose. And when they show you the list of people that are witnesses against you, on each side, there were the elders' names on Herb's list. So that's when I just really, really fell into really deep depression. I can't even explain how bad it was. All I thought about 24 hours a day was how I was going to kill myself. That's pretty that's pretty bad, because when I was a witness, you know, not seeking help from outside people, so it was really difficult for me to even talk to a psychiatrist, and I don't think I ever really trusted him. So I don't think he was ever really able to help me, because I just felt like, well, maybe he would turn it against me, or somehow like the elders had, you know, use it against you eventually. So I figured I couldn't trust him with anything. But I still went to him, and he put me on Valium because he said I was getting hysterical. So now I was on antidepressants, the alcohol, and the Valium. So I would be up and down all the time. I mean, if I got real down, I'd take something else and get up. And I was crying hysterically most of the time. And I just really was depressed. And I turned back to that church with that pastor. And I went there one day, just a total mess, just falling apart. And he comes out, you know, this big Indian guy, and he puts his arm around me, and he said, you know, we'll work it out. It'll be okay. And I thought, oh, good grief. I said, now here I am in this church, all alone with this married pastor who's got his arm around me. I said, now I'm going to be in big trouble. I said, as if I don't have enough trouble. Because, you know, the elders, they never allowed to be alone with you. You know, they always had to have two whenever they went with a woman, you know. They were never, because I didn't have a husband that was in the truth, so I always had to be two. So now here's this pastor, and I'm there. Oh, well, I don't care anymore. Let, you know, people get all upset about it. But we just talked about it, and I kept going back and going back, and we just kept talking, and eventually he led me to Jesus. But praise the Lord, he was just so loving, and he just, you know, really encouraged me and said that, you know, the truth would come out, and that, you know, Jesus would heal this and really work it out with the kids. But I accepted it in my mind with Jesus. You know, I knew what he was saying was right, but it wasn't getting through to my heart. My heart was like, I knew it. I'm there. Yeah, I know. I know I should accept Jesus. I know what he's done. I know everything. But I just couldn't. I just really didn't trust him. And I felt very distant from Jesus, even though I had accepted him. I think it all has to do with the emotions of a witness, that when you don't have any emotions, you don't express any emotions, you never learn how to be emotional. I had to learn how to really let my heart work, because my heart had been so broken between the kids and the relationship with my husband and the relationship with the Watchtower, that I just couldn't. There was just something in me. It was gone. It wasn't there anymore. And it was only through prayer and through prayer of the pastor and eventually the church that I went to, that I really did come to accept Jesus in my heart. And I had to learn how to pray all over again. And that's why I really recommend this book. It's by Richard DeHaan. It's called Pray, God is Listening. This is a fantastic book. It is a small book. You can get it in a Christian bookstore. But if anybody can't get it and they want to write to me, and I can get one at mine, because it is really, it's a great book. It teaches you all, it's very simple to pray, but it teaches you really how to pray from your heart. Because a couple of big things that I had was, you know, when I accepted Jesus, I expected this big bolt of lightning to come over me and everything was going to be wonderful. That's what everybody says, you know, they accept Jesus and everything's wonderful. Well, everything wasn't wonderful. And I just couldn't understand that. And Matthew 7, verse 7 really spoke to me. It says, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. And that is so true, because those are the things that I wasn't doing. I was just sitting back and expecting it all to happen. I wasn't seeking. I wasn't knocking. I wasn't asking. I was just there. And that was a very important thing. Another thing was that because God knows everything that's going to go on, I couldn't understand why we had to pray to him. Why pray to somebody that already knows everything that's going to happen? I mean, if he's a sovereign God, you know, what difference does it make if our life is already planned out? You know, why? Why pray? And this book really answered that for me. It says, if God is sovereign and knows ahead of time everything that is going to happen, why should we even bother to pray? And it answers that, and it says, don't forget, the Lord's eternal foreknowledge took our prayers into consideration. He has worked them into his plan and into the very fabric of the universe. From all eternity, God knew the exact situations in which we would find ourselves. He knew how we would respond. So knowing full well whether or not we would pray, he made his all-wise plans and provisions for an answer. So that just really convicted my heart of how much we really needed to pray, because he knew already our prayers. And no one had ever told me that. And when I really realized that the reason that everything is planned out, because he knew our prayers, he knew what we were going to do, and he knew how he was going to answer them. And that to me was just the real eye-opener. After Jim, when I married Jim, he was a Christian too, but he wasn't very active. And we really didn't have a church to go to. So I would send Jim out and he would search for churches. And he'd come back and tell me what they were like. And so then I'd go and I'd say, no, I don't like that one, no, I don't like this one. So finally we found one that we really liked. And even though it took a long time for me to adjust not having custody of the children, it took about 2 years, and I saw them once a week and every other weekend, I eventually got a healing from that, and the Lord really spoke to me, and I just really realized that I would just give them all the support and love that I could when they were with me. So eventually the abuse did start with my daughter again with her father, and so she came to live with me 2 years ago. And my son still lives with his father, but he comes every once a week. He goes to church and youth group, and he goes to church on Sunday with us, and he really has a love for the Lord. Christina has accepted Jesus as her Savior. She attended the Christian high school now. And Matthew also has accepted Jesus, but his heart yet is like mine was in a way. He just hasn't really softened to the Word. It really, I don't really know whether it's getting in. He keeps on telling me it is, and we keep talking about it. Yeah, I know, you know. But I just have a feeling about him not living in a non-Christian environment like he is, because Herb still never became a witness. I didn't tell you that. After he got what he wanted out of them, he turned on them, and he now tells everyone the reason we got a divorce is because I was a witness. And so Herb would never come to wanting anything to do with God. He said he doesn't need God in his life, and he doesn't need anything. And so Matthew has to live with that. But yet Matthew will often say to me he'd like to come and live with me. But I think he's still afraid, really, to leave his father. And Jim and I also have another new son, Michael Anthony. He's 14 months old. And he's just been a wonderful gift from the Lord for us. He's been a marvelous way of healing. And he's just a terrific little guy. I'm sure you've seen him running around downstairs. Both the other children love Mikey, and he's just a sweetheart. And the Lord has really blessed us with the ministry, Set Free Ministries that we have, because I truly have been set free. Not only being in bondage to a husband that was miserable to me, but an organization that was cruel to me as well, just to be set free from all of that, to know Jesus has just really been unbelievable in my life. It really has. And the ministry has just been great. People have been saved, and you know, studies have been broken, and it's funny how it just snowballs. You know, one woman answered the ad and was worried about her mother, and then she found out her mother was studying with someone else she knew, and she said, should I call him up? I said, call her up. I said, yeah, call her up. I said, wouldn't you do something if she was going to drive off a bridge that was broken? I said, do something for her. Call her and tell her. So she did. And the woman wanted to talk to me, and I went out and talked to her, and she stopped her study, and her mother stopped her study, and it's just, and they both came to the Lord. It's just really, really been a blessing, you know. And when I see it, I really see what the Lord can do. And the other ministries that I have met here, I could never have done it if I hadn't come here. You know, Jesus led me here. Jesus is running this whole thing, using Joan and Bill and all these other ministries. You know, David Reed and all of his things, he's working right there in Massachusetts with us. When we have a question, we can call him, and his books and his help with our, we have a 24-hour telephone line, and his help with that, and Make Sure Ministries with their help by helping us 1 year with a whole packet that they put out was just, you know, just so wonderful. Just so many different people that have really helped here. And we can just really see that, you know, Jesus does live, and that I'm alive, and that we all live in Him, and that we live joyously for Him. And it's not any more of a bondage to an organization.